And now that you do have coffee and something in your stomach, right, it's a better morning. It's also a sunshiny morning, and we all survived the storm last night, correct? So we're all happy to be here. Did anybody get any sleep? It was pretty wild evening, or a whole night, as a matter of fact. But we're so glad you're here. I'm Lucinda Lee, Vice President for Information Technology and CIO at Middle Tennessee State University and the chair of the Instructional Technology Conference. This is our 11th year. We can hardly believe that. We welcome each of you so much to this conference, and we hope that it will be an enjoyable and a meaningful and a wonderful learning experience for each of you. We have in attendance nearly 300 faculty, college and university administrators, and instructional technology specialists from 24 states, from Oregon to Florida and from the East Coast to the West Coast. So we are excited about having this widespread participation. Born in Montreal, Quebec, Stephen Downs lived and worked across Canada before joining the National Research Council as a senior researcher in November 2001. He's currently based in Moncton, New Brunswick, at the Institute for Information Technology's e-learning research group. Stephen has become a leading voice in the areas of learning objects and metadata, as well as the emerging fields of weblogs in education and content syndication. He's perhaps best known for his daily research newsletter, OL Daily, or it's short for Online Learning Daily, which reaches thousands of readers across Canada and around the world. His work also includes the development of educational content syndication systems such as EDU RSS and DLORN, which is about the design of a digital rights management system for learning resources. He's also frequently found on the road giving seminars and lectures on the fields of online learning, and that includes some recent work in Perth, Australia, and so forth. So I've heard Stephen speak. I guarantee you that he will be provocative probably this morning, if nothing else. And again, as Dr. Gebert said, thank you, Stephen, for the beautiful slides. That kind of helped since we weren't having breakfast yet. If you came in and saw those, he's just recently been on a sojourn in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, and it's just gorgeous. So we thank you, and we welcome you much here this morning, Stephen Downs.
Thanks. I was afraid I'd be stuck in that chair. I was also wondering who you were talking about. Thank you. Thank you for the welcome, the very generous welcome, and I'd like to bring you all greetings from the people of Canada. It's my pleasure to be here. This is my first time ever in this part of the world, certainly my first time in Tennessee, my first time in anything like the U.S. South, except for Texas. I've been to Texas. Last night was my very first tornado warning. So you know, it's kind of an interesting thing. We don't have really much in the way of tornadoes in Canada, although I do remember many years ago we had a tornado in Edmonton. If you're wondering what I'm doing here now, okay, now the talk is officially beginning. I forgot to do this. I've been away for a little while, so I've forgotten all of my regular routines and things. This is a piece of software called Audacity. It's open source, freeware, and I'm using it to record the talk as I give it. So we'll just make that go away and come to the ubiquitous PowerPoint slides. What can I say? For those of you who know me know that I've been away for the last little while, and as Lucinda mentioned, I have been on an island in the Gulf of St. Lawrence in the middle of nowhere, and I've done that, you know, and things like last night's tornado warning put this in perspective. I've done that to try to think about what it is that I'm up to and what it is that I'm trying to do with instructional technology and RSS and distributed learning and all of that sort of stuff. A lot of that's in my head right now. I wasn't planning on doing that when I planned to do this talk. When I planned to do this talk, I gave a talk in Colorado at EduCause, and that's the talk that Lucinda saw. And on the basis of that talk, she had me invited here, but on the grounds that I did not give that talk, which I found kind of interesting. And, you know, and I'm thinking about it. I'm thinking Tennessee. I've never been to Tennessee, and I've never... The only thing I know about Tennessee is the movie Castaway, which is sort of odd. Well, and the Nashville Predators. Well, it's not completely true either. I know a little bit. But the thing about the movie Castaway that I liked about Castaway is that it did put things in perspective in the sense that it tells you to keep going because you never know what the tide is going to bring in. And those are the sorts of thoughts that I was having while I was sitting on that island. And the reason why I'm talking about this is because I'm trying to, in kind of a roundabout way, get at the purpose of what we're doing. You know, I do a lot of talks in educational technology, and I probably will continue to do talks in educational technology because I know a little bit about it. And I hear a lot of the time, and indeed even when we were talking last night a little bit, you know, it's not about the technology, it's about the learning. And the technology is just a means of getting at the learning. And the comment was made yesterday, you know, you go to a school or whatever and you see the students with their cell phones in their ears, and the question was asked, you know, were they always like that? I mean, would they be like that without the cell phones? And the thinking was, well, yeah, they probably would be. And I'm thinking about that. And so we say, okay, well, it's not about the technology, it's about the learning. But, you know, I think about Castaway, and I think about my island in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, and I realize it's not about the learning either. The learning is a means to an end. And the end, well, we don't know what the end is. The end is different things for different people. And I'm trying to understand this for myself, and, you know, what is it to have a good life? What is it to be engaged in a life? And that's really what we're up to. You know, the learning is just the thing we do to try to get ourselves to have good lives, happy lives, meaningful lives. I won't even say productive lives, because that's something else entirely. And you might ask, why would I go off on a tangent like this? This is supposed to be about educational technology. But it is about educational technology. You know, I wrote a paper back in 1998 called The Future of Online Learning. And if you read The Future of Online Learning today, it's pretty much dead on. And every once in a while I'll write one of these, you know, here's what the future is going to be. And what I don't rely on, absolutely, resolutely don't rely on, are the empirical studies where you go out and you sample 14 graduate students and determine that, oh yeah, they really do like this kind of learning. I don't go on things like educational outcomes, the OECD, PISA tests, standardized testing. Oh, if we do this intervention, they will gain this amount of percentage, because we're not even trying to do that. I mean, if we're trying to produce a good life, then the test of whether our educational system is working is not whether people have learned such and such, but whether they have happy lives. And so I look at that. I look at what do people want in their lives. As John Stuart Mill says, the best evidence that people want something is that they actually want it. And that's the approach that I take to educational technology, and indeed it's the approach I try to take to life. It doesn't always work, but sometimes it does. Sometimes the tide really does bring things in. Now you didn't hear a thing, but if you're listening to this online, you just heard a big thud. That was me waving my hand and making my microphone fall to the ground. I don't have a clock here, so I'm going to depend on someone to time me. Oh, there's a clock up there. Excellent. Thank you. You guys, I always think when I come to these sorts of talks, I'm talking to the wrong people. And the reason why is I'm talking to the people who are invested in this, traditional online learning. You guys, this is your bread and butter. This is actually how you feed your families. And the main purpose of what I have to say about this field is this doesn't work. This is the old way. This is going to change. It will change because it is not what people want. And the evidence that it is not what people want is that when people really want to learn something, this is not what they do. Traditional online learning, institution-based, we're in one, and you know, just thousands of similar institutions. From the perspective of online learning and educational technology, product-based, we talk a lot about learning content, learning objects, learning resources, online courses. Some of you are probably doing CD-ROM stuff. Some of you are doing Flash stuff. And the focus is always ever so much, especially with these learning management systems, the course content, right? And we got to get the content all right, and everything will follow from there. And you know, there are some WebCT people here who are going to be Blackboard people soon. But the whole concept of course packs and things like that comes from WebCT. I remember when WebCT was created. Murray built WebCT, and I built a learning management system at the same time called Ole. And Murray had funding, and I didn't, so he became rich and famous, and I didn't. And it seemed, and it was, such a good idea at the time. I've had conversations, and we think, maybe this was a necessary step. Maybe this is a step that we had to take. You know, and you have to go from where you are, which is, you know, your classroom delivery and all that, through some sort of process where online learning looks an awful lot like traditional learning. And we force people into it, whether they want to be into it or not. But that period has ended. Michael Feldstein wrote, I had lots of arguments with him, but on this we agree. We need a system that is optimized towards slotting in new pieces as they become available, not as an afterthought or an add-on. Think about how learning is designed in your institution, both from a technological point of view, but also from an organizational point of view or an administrative point of view. Could you tomorrow add a class on the events that happened last night? And especially in your online courses or your CD-ROM courses. But you think, well, yeah, maybe, but in any sort of official way, could you give people credit for it? Could you bring in enrollments, all of that sort of thing? Not really. We'd find it hard. We would find it hard to just slot new things into our online courses. If a new type of technology were invented this afternoon, which it could be, or it might have been the last 3 weeks, I haven't been in touch, could you start using it in your learning management system tomorrow? Probably not. Where we're headed is toward what I have loosely called, I've called it various things. I figure it's turnabout is fair play because people call me various things. I'll call this various things. Learning networks. And there's three major features of learning networks that are going to have significant impact on how educational technology rolls out. First of all, and this is where it will hit you the most, it is not institution-based. People are not loyal to institutions. You think they are because, you know, there's banners and there's sports teams and there's alumni and fraternities and all of that. But out there, people aren't loyal that way. And once they're learning outside the 4 years that they had to go to university to get that piece of paper, they'll learn from anyone. They don't care who they're learning from. It's not product-based. We have, and I don't really know how this happened, gone or entered into an environment where learning is seen almost as a good or a service that we create or manufacture or assemble and then deliver to the consumer. That's the picture that we have, isn't it? And that picture is going to change. And it is going to change in precisely the following way, where educational, I don't want to say institutions, but educational providers, I don't want to say providers, educators, instead of providing a service to people, will instead be focused on enabling people to provide that service for themselves. Just like faxes, the fax machine. You remember, some of you, I do anyways, and so it means anyone my age or older, it's probably not that many, but remember when the fax machine came out. And when the fax machine came out, the first thought of how the fax machine was going to be used was by courier services, and they would provide electronic courier service. So instead, you know, the way courier services used to work, you go to the courier office, you give them a message, they give the message to a real fast person, the fast person is running to another place, and they hand deliver the message. Okay, it's not exactly that. They use a truck. But. And the way it was going to work is, in the new electronic age, you'd go to the courier service, you'd give them their message, they would scan it and send it electronically for you. And then at the other end, it would be received electronically and delivered, and you could skip the truck. And it was going to be so much better. Now, it would have been better, except it never came out that way because people discovered they could have their own fax machines. They didn't need the couriers anymore. And they just bypassed them. And you know, right now, I don't think there's any business that depends on, you know, we will send faxes for you. It'd be absurd. You can do it off your computer. You can receive them with your computer. You don't even need fax machines anymore to do a fax, which is kind of ironical when you think about it. The same thing for education. We're locked into this idea, like, and really locked into this idea that this is something that we deliver. It's a service we give them. It was even part of the opening comments. But with the new technology, what this means is we don't have to be providing this service anymore. We are moving into an age where people do it for themselves. And how they do it for themselves is via learning networks. Which leads us to the third thing, because you think, well, we'll at least need course materials and stuff like that. Not so. Not so. Education isn't about the content. Never has been. Oh yeah, we use the content. We use content like we use words. But it's the medium of communication. Education is about engagement. It's about practice. It's about reflection. The content is just the mechanism that we use to get people to that point. Now, how do we know this? We look on the internet and see what people actually do. What's the killer application on the internet? Two guesses. Okay, first guess, web? No. The killer application, the thing people started using first, the thing that hooked people on the internet, was email. Any of you not have email? I discovered when I came back from my island that the world has discovered Web 2.0. I've been involved in this for quite a while. Web 2.0, I think it was in some magazine, I forget. Pardon?
I think
Newsweek? Yeah, Newsweek covered Web 2.0. I guess it's mainstream now. Web 2.0 isn't a fad. The name is a fad. I wrote a paper called E-Learning 2.0, and about 10 minutes later, Jay Cross said, E-Learning 2.0 is passé. It's been overhyped. That's okay. Jay came up with the term e-learning, so people have said that too, so I guess turnabout is fair play. The concept of Web 2.0 is the concept of learning networks, which is the concept that the web changes from a place we go to consume media to a place we go to do things. Or sometimes, as they say, it changes from being a place, broadcast medium, to being a platform. It stops being like the document and starts being like the word processor. And it's kind of a subtle change. What it means, though, is that the people who used to access the web and consume and read the web now produce the web. And if you don't believe me, well, there's a conference blog. I'll plug the conference blog, because the conference blog is a good thing. Because now, instead of the conference organizers putting up a nice conference site, you, the people who are in the conference, can produce the conference coverage. You don't even need reporters. Whoever the guy was taking pictures, they don't need you anymore. Sorry. Nothing personal. Actually, I can take pictures. After all. A smile. Okay. That doesn't have to be good. It doesn't have to be good. It just has to be good enough. It's kind of funny. People talk about quality in education. You know, I hear that. This is a bit of an aside. I hear that so much. Right? We must maintain quality in education. And then, you know, people talking about learning technology and, does e-learning improve educational outcomes? I got into e-learning because the people that I worked with, and I was one of those people, living out in the country, in the Canadian North, First Nations, the choice for them was not between good e-learning and good in-class learning. It was between e-learning or nothing. And, good enough is really good when compared with nothing. And to me, it's always been about the access. And, we look at the way e-learning has spread around the world, and it has been about access, much more so than quality. You need a certain quality, but it doesn't need to be perfect. I showed you a bunch of pictures. Were they perfect? No. Were they good enough? Yeah. What does it look like? It's really hard to picture. I want you to think about Richard Nixon. Now, why? Well, because how many of you have seen Richard Nixon in person? Okay, well, that's three or four more. You don't count. The rest of you have seen Richard Nixon only on television or maybe in a photograph printed in a newspaper or something like that, right? Now, think about that photograph or that representation, that video or TV program. That wasn't really Richard Nixon. You probably knew that. But the thing is, Richard Nixon is one thing. But what you saw was a whole bunch of things. We call them pixels. All right? And you saw them on television, a bunch of different pixels, or even if you looked in the newspaper, you saw a bunch of pixels. And the question is, what made those pixels Richard Nixon? And The answer is they were organized in a certain way. And the way they were organized, they're all sort of distributed, but the way they were organized, the way they were seen and interpreted by you, allowed you to recognize that as a picture of Richard Nixon. Now, imagine the same kind of thing happening, except instead of pixels, we have pictures. And instead of a video screen, we have the World Wide Web. That is what our information environment is beginning to look like. And it sounds kind of bizarre and weird, but that's what we're moving into. So the blog post, somebody will write a blog post, I assume, of this talk. That blog post is like a pixel. And as those pixels come together, one after another, and assemble and are presented to you in a dynamic stream, a picture of this conference, or whatever, a picture of distributed learning, a picture of various things, begins to emerge. And when you see that picture, that's how you recognize the phenomenon you're trying to understand. That is what learning content looks like after the age of content. How's that for a wild? We can actually pull this off. This is actually happening now. I'm not making this up. This is happening now. This is for the techies, those of you who work in metadata and representations of online learning content. Traditionally, metadata was like a library catalog, card catalog. But in a distributed world, you take your card catalog, you take your card out, you rip it up, you throw it to different places, and if you need to bring it together later, you do. The information about a resource is scattered across the web. And we do that in other domains anyways. Think about how we know about a person, your personal profile. There's a lot of talk about personal profiles recently, even in my country. And if you wanted to know about a person, you would not simply rely on their CV or their resume. That would be very dumb. And that same approach is now being or going to be applied to resources on the web, where we learn about a resource by consulting this person and that person and that person. We learn about a person by talking to the credit bureau, the police agency, the university that gave them their grades, friends from college, their barber, whatever. Well, in my case, not their barber. But you know what I mean? You ask a bunch of people, you pull the information together dynamically as you need it, and that gives you a picture in your mind of what that person is like. That's how we will find resources in the future. So we have this dynamic thing where people are creating these resources, they pump these resources into the system, and then we get information about these resources that's pulled together and it creates different pictures. The picture changes moment to moment. What we think about a resource changes moment to moment. This talk is useful today, not so useful 2 years from now. And our knowledge of this talk changes over that time. I'm assuming it's useful today. We'll never know. Learning becomes what is called a network phenomenon. The content is a web of user, that is to say, student-generated content. Those of you who are professors may be asking now, well, what am I going to produce? That's a good question. Learning takes place not in institutions, but in social networks and communities, where these networks and communities are more often than not created by and for the learners themselves. I'm very fond of quoting a paper by Aaron Brewer on the learning that happens in Yahoo groups. Yahoo groups are groups that are formed by the members of those groups for various purposes. Some of the purposes, not all of them by any means, include learning. It's a huge phenomenon. There are millions of groups and millions of blogs. And what happens is this content goes into the web and it mashes. And that's actually a technical term these days. And the way I've characterized it, I believe it's an accurate way, is it's aggregated or brought together, it's remixed, it's repurposed or reshaped or reformed or edited, and then it's fed forward. It's distributed to other people. No professionals are needed. And from the point of view of learning, the learner's window on all of this is what's being called these days the Personal Learning Center, or the PLC, because they had to abbreviate it. Here's what the PLC looks like. I wonder if I can make this bigger. Whoops. Well, not like that, I can't. Oh, well. Sorry, I want to make it bigger. That's bigger. It might be too big. Oh, well. You guys can see that, eh? Oops. There we go. This diagram's by Scott Wilson, thought of as the most influential diagram of the last year in our field. At the center is the thing called Future VLE, or Virtual Learning Environment. And the idea, compare this to a learning management system, right, where everything is all in the one computer and you're a big whopping database. Here, the future VLE is almost as simple as a browser. Almost. And the way it works is it taps into a whole bunch of different resources in different places around the internet. In this picture, LiveJournal in the upper left, blogging system for students and teachers' blogs. LearnDirect, learning services company. Personal hosting for your own content. 43 Things for to-do lists. Flickr for photographs. Things like that. And the mechanism that makes this possible, you can't really see, it's just a little tiny print here, are the protocols or the APIs, application program interfaces, that allow distributed things to talk to each other. You know, and again, I don't know how much people here are involved in learning object metadata and all of that sort of stuff, all those standards. The guiding principle for these things are, well, there is only one, simplicity. Well, maybe there's two, flexibility. They're not standards. People always talk about standards. And, you know, as soon as we got learning object metadata, everybody wanted to standardize it. And there's one standard for everyone. These aren't standards. They're protocols. And the difference is, everyone has to use a standard. They have to use it exactly the way it's written. And if you don't, it's broken. But in a protocol, you use it the way it's written if you want. And if you don't want to use it that way, you don't. You use something different. How many of you are familiar with RSS? Good. About half. RSS is an XML protocol that describes the syndication, or the feeding forward, of online content, such as blog posts. And RSS is a type of XML which is very simple. At heart, it has three fields: title, link, description. You can actually get away without the description. And actually, depending on the reader, you can get away without the title. Of course, that doesn't make for a very useful RSS, but you don't have to. But the thing is, title, link, description. And what happened, what has happened and continues to happen out there is people add different elements or use those elements differently if they find them useful. So some people have added an author element. They borrow from Dublin Core and they say, oh, we'll just borrow this and we'll pop it into RSS and we'll call that the author element. It's actually the Dublin Core author element, but who cares? Because it's a protocol. You just want to stuff it in there, you do. And the idea is that it becomes the mechanism for sharing data if people actually use it. John Stuart Mill. The best evidence that something is wanted is that people actually want it. Who would have thought that a quote from On Liberty would be useful for the development of educational technology standards? But that is the environment that we are moving into. And if you think about it, educational technology, liberty. We are in for a profound change. We're bringing liberty to education. User-generated content, not objective, factual reporting produced by professionals, but personal points of view that draw from personal experiences, life experiences, what is relevant to you now. Because the totality of those produce a picture that is much more objective and much more real than any effort to produce something that is objective. And the evidence for that is a site called Wikipedia. How many of you have heard of Wikipedia? Good. For the rest of you, and it is a very small minority, you can look it up on Google. But the point is, Wikipedia produces objectivity by not requiring it. Network of interactions. Right. Our activity on the web is characterized, and this is true for all of us. It's true for each and every one of you, if you sit and analyze this for a bit, is not consumption, but interaction with a network of your friends, of your family, your peers, complete and total strangers. Who knows? And it's this dynamics of this network of interactions that creates the meaning and the semantics and the content that we see in the new web. There's been a lot of work done on networks, social networks, structures of social networks. I might have the other slide here, James Sirwicki, The Wisdom of Crowds, things like that, where, again, you can produce knowledge by having a collection of people interacting with each other. You don't need to depend on the professionals to produce knowledge, and indeed, if you do, the knowledge that is produced will be worse than the knowledge that is produced by a network of amateurs. That is well established. What do we call that in economics? We call that the free market. You'd never believe I'm a socialist, would you? Here's my picture of the architecture, the major components. I'm not going to describe these components each in detail because I don't have time in this talk. But if you're looking for the things to watch for and recognize as elements of what might be called e-learning 2.0, these are the elements. Resource profiles, that's the distributed type of metadata or description that I talked about. Resource production, is the introduction of new materials into the system. Repositories are systems or types of software that hold, store, and allow for the indexing of produced resources. From repositories, content is syndicated or distributed out. And that content is then aggregated through the process of resource aggregation. This is sometimes associated with digital rights. Not digital rights in the lock it down, nobody will ever be allowed to see this without signing away their mother, but digital rights in the sense that somebody says, I own this, and the other person says, okay, I'll give you credit when I use it, and that's digital rights. It's not digital rights the way the publishers think digital rights should be, but I've just mentioned publishers are now irrelevant anyways, so we don't need their digital rights mechanisms either. I know a lot of you deal with DRM. Think about it. If you got rid of the publishers, you wouldn't have to deal with all this DRM stuff anymore. Think about it. What would make your life easier? Why are you dealing with the publishers? The common environment, that's the new VLE, the personal learning environment that I've been talking about. community, the social network, the interactions that happen between people that create this network of content, and then personal identity, the glue that holds it together, the thing that makes you on the internet you. I've talked a bit about blogs already. What's happened in the last year is that this network of content has gone from being text-based blog-type content where people write things to full multimedia content. What I showed you before was a video, right? It was a video with moving pictures and all of that, completely amateurly produced, but hopefully good enough to fill the 10 minutes before this session began. That is what has begun to flood onto the internet. Podcasting. How many of you have heard of podcasting? Sure. Everyone. Podcasting is like a year and a half old. The production of audio content. This is dead. Wow, that's really unfortunate. It's probably when I dropped it. Yep. Okay, for those of you who have been listening to half an hour of silence, now what do you do? Okay, for those of you who are listening online, I dropped the microphone, it hit the off button, I forgot to check and make sure I was still recording, and, well, the rest is, well, quite literally history. Anyhow, that's too bad. Well, you guys... I guess nobody else was recording this, right? From now on, when you go to a talk or a lecture or something like that, take an iRiver or a Creative Zen or whatever and record the thing. Are you recording it? You rock. You are my hero. I'll talk to you later. And the point is, the reason is, we don't need recording studios or anything. We don't even need production houses or anything like that to produce educational resources. I'm producing an educational resource right now. I've got visual components. I've got audio. If I had more bandwidth and a little bit of technical ability, I'd be videoing it. So some of my other talks have been videoed. And, you know, I actually need to learn how to work with that, because I'm not young, so I don't know a lot of these things. And all of this is flooding into the internet. And it is replacing, quite literally replacing, traditional content. Podcasting, again, I don't have it there. If you're interested in finding audio, look for something like the PodSafe Music Network. That's where your future top 10 music will come from, not from the recording studios. I guess this is really relevant being so close to Nashville. I hadn't thought of that. It's not here anymore. I was looking for something. I went to the PodSafe Music Network to find some country music, and I found some country music free that I can use, and it's real good. And anyhow, never mind. Odeo is like a blogger for audio content. You want to produce some audio content of your own on the internet and make it available for everyone. Create an account on Odeo and then use your cell phone and phone it in. You can quite literally phone in your content and you now have an audio blog. There's vlogging or video blogging. I could go on. Various ed tech type podcasts that are out there. I've participated in all three of the ones that I've listed there. Bob Sprankle is very well known for using podcasts in his, I believe it's grade 7 class, and so on. And what I'm trying to get at here is just the huge volume of content that is now being produced and is in the process of replacing traditional educational content. Okay. Let's see if this... Here we go. What this is a piece of software that I wrote called MyGlue. And what my glue does is it takes the RSS output from various services, including Flickr. If you were watching this show before, or watching the slides before, you'd recognize that photo from my slideshow. There's the actual photo sitting on Flickr. Flickr is a place that hosts your photos. You upload your photos to Flickr, and then it produces an RSS feed so that you can syndicate or distribute your photos. And what MyGlue does is it reads those feeds and brings them together. So it reads the feed from Flickr. It reads the feed from my own website. It reads the feed from an online bookmarking service that I use called Delicious, and it brings them together so that my presence on the web isn't my single site, but it's distributed across all of these places where I've left my content, and then I bring it all together. And you can have different views of me, can't you? You can have the visual Stephen, where you just get my visual content. Or you can get the loud, opinionated Stephen, where you forget the photos, you forget the audio. Well, maybe you bring in the audio for that, but anyhow. So there's that. So I thought that was pretty cool. I decided to bring all the pieces together. And this is the thing I called RSS Writer. And what I want you to note, too, MyGlue and RSS Writer, I want you to think about your learning management systems, which cost you, what, $50,000, $100,000, tens of thousands of lines of code. Those of you from WebCTs, it's tens of thousands of lines of code now, right? These services, both of them put together, are about 150 lines of computer code. They're also available for free. You can use them. So what RSS Writer is a place where I can read content from a variety of sources, and in this case, MyGlue. I take this content and put it into my editor here. And I can mess around with this content a bit. Get rid of hello. What else? It's really hard to be creative while you're giving a talk. It's even hard to spell hello. Is that right? I don't know. Let's pretend it is. And what is my user ID? I hope this is right. Cover your eyes. Yeah. Okay. Give that a couple of seconds here. All right. And if we go to Blogger, actually, I'll go to. You've all heard of Blogger, right? Sure, we're not. Oh, because I typed it. There's my Yukon Mania blog in Blogger, and there's the post that I've just created, and that is now winging its way around the world. I've just created an educational resource. If I'd had another 10 minutes in this talk, I would have taken the photo that I took earlier. I actually took one thinking I was going to do that, but the preamble was a bit too long. And I would have uploaded that photo to Flickr so that you would have actually seen the photo of yourself in an educational resource before the end of the talk. I actually did that to the people in Alaska. I produced that particular resource during the talk. And ask yourself now, what is the future of learning resources when they can be produced by a speaker using technology that costs basically nothing, while the speaker is giving the talk. Why on earth would we hire anyone to do this? Why can't our students do this and in the process learn better and become part of the service that they are trying to access? That is where our learning is going. Collaborative authoring. You don't have to do it by yourself anymore. There's a site out there called Writely. Writely's a pretty cool site. Writely's a site that's a word processor. Remember I said Web 2.0 is more like the word processor than the word document. And what's neat about Writely is you and your friends can write the same document at the same time. Whoops. Connections, ICQ, Skype, instant messaging. And the thing is, all of these things hook into each other. You do something you like on Writely, you can feed it into Wikipedia. The RSS writer that I just showed you, I haven't done it yet, but one of the things that you're going to be able to do is pull in not just RSS feeds, but Wikipedia pages, Google search results. Bering Strait School District's Open Content Initiative. I'll bring that right into RSS Writer. If they produce something, I'll bring it in. I'll have a look at it. I think it's neat. Mash it up a bit, repurpose it, feed it forward. It becomes another resource. A whole new set of resources produced every single day. For this to work, and this is where a lot of my advocacy comes from, you need open source and open content. All of the software that I've showed you here is free. The things that I've written are also open source, so you can go in there and make them work properly. Hide the passwords. Open content is a huge and growing area in our field, so much so that I question the wisdom of purchasing any sort of content at this point. And here are some of the resources, both for the production of content and for the sharing of content. All of this together, and if you're wondering, because I've thrown a lot at you here, and I know I have, and thanks to a wonderful audience member, you'll be able to listen to this talk later. I'll put it up on my website later today. My website is Downes, Downes.ca, and if you go to the website later today, you'll be able to get the slides and, with some luck, the audio for this talk, and so you'll be able to review it. But looking at this, looking at how information is produced, passed on, learned in this kind of environment, an approach to learning that George Siemens calls connectivism. And I've drawn on that as well and talked about connective knowledge, which you'll also find on my website. If you think about that network and you're wondering, how do I determine whether some technology that's being pitched to me at, say, a technology conference, is this type of technology or old technology? There are four basic principles that you can rely on that act as a guide for you, and I've listed them here. First principle is autonomy. Does it allow people using the technology to be autonomous? Does it allow them to make their own decisions, to configure their own environment, to use their own services, to create their own content? Or are the users dependent? Are they forced to use a particular type of software, a particular data format, a particular resource provider? Diversity. Does the technology or the approach or the learning methodology or whatever allow for a diversity of approaches, not just diversity in the sense that we're used to using diversity in, you know, socioeconomic terms, but diversity. Can you use different programming languages? Can you use different types of computers? Can you use an iPod to access the content as well as a desktop, as well as your toaster? That kind of diversity. openness. Can anybody add content to the system? Or is it restricted to a privileged few? Can anybody get content from the system and use it for their own purposes? Or do you require, again, signing a license in your own blood to do that? And then finally, interaction. And I think this is the most important. Does it help people communicate with each other? Does it create those kind of connections which are the things that people look for, not from an education, but from a life worth living? That's my talk, and I thank you very much for your time and attention.
The question was, what about validated information? And that's a question, how do we know what was said is true? And the way we know that something is true is we go out and we look and we see whether or not it's true. And the best way to do that is to have many people looking at it, many eyes, many points of view. Our traditional way of doing things is we ask an expert, and if the expert says it's true, then it's true. But I think experience has shown us that if we can find a bunch of people who've actually seen whatever it is that we're talking about, we don't need to depend on the expert, and we're going to get better results. And so that's how I would address the question of reliability and truth.
So, could you say a little bit more about the role of the faculty person in helping to guide the students into teaching themselves?
Yeah, I have a very simple educational theory, and in fact, my theory is so simple that I'll never get credit for having an educational theory. And my educational theory is that on the learner side, education consists of practice and reflection. And on the educator side, it consists of demonstration and modeling. And so what I say to educators is that they should be the person they want their students to become. And then everything flows from that. Like I said, I'll never get credit for having a theory.
So the publishing company and the software company
plugging? No. Well, Blackboard, just the day before I went to my island. It's not really my island, it belongs to the government of Quebec, but the day before I went there, Blackboard issued a press release. And the press release was something along the lines of Blackboard to embrace e-learning 2.0. And I read through this, and George Siemens, who the guy with Connectivism, read through this, and we both commented on it, but I liked George's comment better. He said, Blackboard should send George and I royalties. They may not like what I have to say, and they may not like me personally. I don't know if they like me personally. They don't really talk to me a lot. But the thing is, I'm not telling them things that I don't think are true. In fact, my own feeling is that I believe I am providing a service to Blackboard and WebCT, which I did warn about mergers and acquisitions, by telling them this is what's going to happen. And it doesn't matter what the publishers and the software companies say. It just doesn't matter what they say. They are already irrelevant. They don't realize it yet, but they are already irrelevant. Look at journal publishing. Right? Right now, journal publishing is a commercial industry where an author publishes writes a paper, signs over all rights to a publisher who publishes the paper and then charges the author for copies. And the author, of course, gets nothing for any of this. And that model is being replaced by what is called open access publishing, where the authors take the paper that they've written and they put it on a website. And that's publishing. And you might say, well, how can you run a system like that? It turns out that it works pretty well, because the old way, 13% of all papers that were written were ever read. And now all of them are. And yeah, a lot of them aren't good, but instead of a committee of three or four secret people determining which ones are good, everyone does. And when everyone determines what papers are good, it turns out the ones that are actually good are the ones that are widely read, as opposed to the ones that we hope are good, maybe if the referee system works. Commercial journal publishing is obsolete. It is completely obsolete. And I talk to publishers. I talk to them on a regular basis, and they don't always like what I have to say. But they are now trying to figure out how to deal with open access publishing, because they know that they will die if they don't. And it's Elsevier has a system in place now that allows for an author to opt to have their paper published through Elsevier via open access if they get foundation or some other support for the cost of publishing and hosting that paper. That model is going to replace the commercial model that we know now. So, doesn't matter whether they like me.
It's rather unstoppable.
But you know what? It's unstoppable because it's a good thing. It's unstoppable because it means everybody, no matter who they are, get to access an education and get to read these academic papers. And that, in my mind, is the bottom line.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Please have a good day, and we'll see you this evening. Or at lunch. Lunch first.